Welcome to the Whiskey Congress. Honest, open talk dedicated to speaking the truth to those who are open to hearing it. Black, white, right, left. Most importantly, honest, bold, and fueled by good whiskey. In Whiskey Veritas, we are Whiskey Congress. Join the evolution.
Whiskey Congress is back in session. Steven is not here today, but I'm joined by a friend of the show and someone who's appeared on the show multiple times. Ben, we call him Whiskey Ben because he's, among many other things, a distiller, and he's calling in from Kentucky. How you doing, man?
Hey, doing great, man. How are you?
Great. Thanks again. We talked about your wedding briefly. We didn't want to make you a show topic without your knowledge, but we did. Steve and I did come down for your wedding. It was a great time. The venue was absolutely amazing. The distillery, the courtyard where the wedding was, if I hadn't sweated through everything, I wouldn't have made such a spectacle of myself, hopefully. But I was just dripping with sweat. But it was an awesome venue. That courtyard was beautiful. It looks like a castle.
I mean, yeah, and that's what it's, the distillery name is Castle and Key. It was originally the old Taylor Distillery. Built in the late 1800s, and some investors purchased it early 2000s. It had been laying dormant for decades and have started to renovate it. They have the new distillery going there, and it's an absolutely beautiful place to visit here in Kentucky.
Agreed. Okay, so we've traded text messages all week, and one thing that you sent to me that I knew was coming, but I didn't get to look into it, was I think you just like, holy hell, SCOTUS, I think was your text or something to that effect. So the Supreme Court came down and kind of decided on the presidential immunity issue. So if you don't know, this is a case related to Trump directly, and it has to do with the claim that presidents can't be held criminally liable or responsible for ? So what are they immune from prosecution for? And the Supreme Court came out and said essentially that presidential acts cannot be prosecuted. Now that leads the question, what is a presidential act?
And yeah, I think it just left that wide open. So what do we define here, and how is this going to be executed going forward? I mean, this was just freaking, I just looked at it as Pandora's box. You know, this just opened up the possibility, especially when you have decisions like this or anything, there's always the unintended consequences. What are the unintended consequences that are going to roll forth from this?
Yeah, and well, and the vagueness of it, I doubt, is an accident. You know, when they, but to me, this feels as much as anything like kicking the can down the road. I think this now goes back to the original court that decided the case or put the case forward to the Supreme Court. And this will linger on, and it will certainly impact some of the Trump prosecutions. But, you know, honestly, I'm exhausted with the Trump prosecution shit. I'm not saying if you've listened to the show for 30 seconds, you know I am not a fan of Donald J. Trump in any way, shape, or form. But, you know, I don't view victory as putting Trump in jail. I view victory as beating Trump at the ballot box, which I'm very concerned about. I mean, we talked about the debate last week. You know, Biden looked awful. He's been trying to be on the comeback trail. We can revisit that in a bit, I guess. But, you know, he's said he's not going to step down, despite the fact that multiple outlets, whether media or political, have said, Joe, it's time to hang him up. I really wish he would hang him up. And I even have a candidate to replace him with that is not well known. I brought him up last week, but Roy Cooper, the North Carolina governor, who is limiting out of his role. And I don't know a whole lot about the guy other than he's a Democrat who won twice in a statewide election in North Carolina, which tells me he's probably good at, you know, not losing the anti-gun group or not losing the gun, you know, the gun rights groups, because that's where Joe Biden is a liability and Gavin Newsom would be an absolute catastrophe as a Democratic nominee.
I think let's jump back to the Supreme Court shortly, but let's deal with this right here with Biden and this, the situation going there. Roy Cooper, same thing here in Kentucky. There's been conversation about Governor Beshear being a potential replacement candidate because kind of dealing with the same thing. He's a Democratic governor who has won and gained, you know, a good deal of support in a very red state. And that says something for him to be able to work both sides of the aisle and not get extreme one way or the other. But I think we've got some, there's some problems. So one thing I wanted to touch on with the Biden situation, he's refusing to step down. We all know the disaster of the debate. I think the whole thing he's doing now with trying to salvage that a little bit, in my opinion, it hasn't gone very well. And I think the damage is pretty much done. The questions I have is, number one, when you're, as a president, one of the biggest things that every president deals with is legacy. Okay, so the main thing that he has built his presidency upon is that he beat Trump the first time around. He was the guy that could beat Trump. Okay, but if you lose to him now, you've just burned all of that down.
Yeah.
I mean, you burned it all. And then what is going to happen to the Democratic Party? Because that's what I just see this being a massive, just, I don't know, firestorm, eruption, whatever, within the Democratic Party. If they were to, if Biden stays the course and they lose to Trump, I mean, you know, just curious to see what the behind the scene politics between the DNC and everybody else, how this would play out. Because to me, this would be absolutely disastrous.
I think you're right. If they lose, and that's a very good point, because his legacy currently is the guy who ousted Donald Trump. Right. If he steps down, his legacy is, I'm the guy who stepped in, did what I said I was going to do, was a bridge to the next younger group of Democratic politicians. And That's, to me, a pretty appealing legacy. And you're right. If he loses to Trump, he's the grumpy old guy who couldn't let it go and put Trump back in the White House. And That's a legacy I don't think any Democrat would want.
No, not at all. And the questions I have, you know, I'm with you guys. I was never a fan of Biden. I mean, guys, people who've not listened or heard me on here before, philosophically, I tend to be more libertarian, but I'm also very pragmatic. I'm a former conservative Republican, but I identify as independent. That's just kind of where I'm at. And I don't like Trump or Biden at all. The questions I have is, you look at where Biden was 3 years ago. You look at where he is now. What's he going to look like in another 4 years if he wins again? Because the question is, can he do the job now? Yes, maybe he can still do the job now, but I have serious doubts about that, because it's come out in the governor's meeting. Basically, he's good between 10 and 4. So the world just shuts down between those hours before and after that? And I get other presidents, et cetera, but it's just like, this has real concerns for me. And it's like, when you're aging, there is serious acceleration in the aging process, the older you get. And where's he going to be in 1 year? Where's he going to be in 2 years? At the end of another 4 years, where's this guy going to be, if he's even still walking and talking, you know?
Right.
And that's something I think voters have to seriously consider. But then that turns around and that leaves you with Trump. And that's a road I can't go down either. The other thing that you deal with, and you talk about a potential new candidate, and I think that's going to be the big issue, is if you replace Biden, who's it going to be? And more than likely, it's going to have to be Kamala Harris because of the money issue. They have a $200-something million war chest, and I've been digging this week into, what do you do with the money if Biden steps down? It can go directly to Harris because she's part of the ticket. But if not, there's a few other options, and it gets very tricky as to how that works with supporting another candidate. So I think that may be one of the reasons why Biden stay in the course, or that you have people supporting him to stay the course. But.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know if Harris is, she's gotten a bad rap since she's been vice president, but no vice president other than Dick Cheney has really been at the front and center of an administration's spotlight. And even Dick Cheney tried not to be in the spotlight. He was just doing a bunch of shit that I would call evil behind the scenes. And how Dick Cheney is still alive, by the way, is a testament to maybe why Joe Biden could continue to do the job, because that guy's, I mean, he's right up there with Mick Jagger and Keith Richards as a freak of nature. Like, how can that guy still be kicking it? But they are. Yeah, so anyway, I do kind of think that the Supreme Court decision is a kick the can down the road situation. Did you want to say anything else about?
I just think, you know, to me, it brings up the, I'm not a lawyer like Steve, et cetera. I have studied a lot of on the Constitution and constitutional law. There was a time that I wanted to get into law school. That's a whole other story down the road. But, you know, the question I have is like impeachment, you know, trying for high crimes and misdemeanors. What exactly does that mean now with this decision? And how does that play out? So the checks and balances that are supposed to be there, this feels like it just kind of wiped a lot of that out.
Well, I think in terms of impeachment, I see what you're saying, and I also don't know. But I would think that being a congressional process, not a Department of Justice process, might not be impacted. My problem with impeachment is it's now become, we are now being run by elderly children. Because it's, you impeach our guy, so now we're going to impeach yours. I mean, it is literally, I've heard people say that in Congress. They're elected officials who've said essentially that. And it's just mind-blowing to me that you can say those words and not feel like a moron. And then I pointed out to someone, they're like, well, yeah, I kind of feel that way. Oh, they impeach Trump. It's only fair. I'm like, oh, my God. Anytime a kid says something's not fair, the always response is, life isn't fair. But when a politician says it, that's a rallying cry. I do not get it.
And that's what drives me crazy about politics now. And I mean, it kind of started with the Republicans with Bill Clinton getting this ball rolling. But it just seems like whoever is in power, the other side is just going to do what the other side did to try to get them out and then step it up. And we just continue to ratchet up and ratchet up and ratchet up. And it's just
right. Congress is now more about obstruction than it is about accomplishments. And
exactly.
then occasionally something will come through, and like the border bill that made it through the Senate with a 70-30 vote or something very close to that gets killed before it even gets on the House floor because of politics. So finally something that they in theory could have and should have agreed on, and your former Senator Lindsey Graham railed for the House to pass this thing and then railed for the House to kill it.
Yep.
I mean, we've spoken about Lindsey Graham in the past. I find the guy fascinating in the sense that he can literally go on national TV, say one thing, the next week say the absolute opposite of that, keep a straight face, and not be held accountable. I would love to have that lack of accountability in my personal professional life.
He is an absolute political chameleon. And even when I was involved in the Republican Party in South Carolina, years ago when he was a congressman and looking to replace Strom Thurmond when he retired, there was questions about where exactly does he stand politically. I was having arguments with guys about, is he actually a conservative? Is he not a conservative? What, you know, where does he fit? And just the way he seems to constantly change his colors, just depending on whichever way he feels the wind is blowing. And again, never held accountable. I do know from being in South Carolina, there were a lot of Republicans frustrated with him, but it seemed like every time he primaried, there would be 10 or 12 people running against him, which would dilute the vote, and then he would just win because, well, you know, for incumbents, that name recognition is a very powerful tool on the ballot. So
it is, and nothing illustrates his, I'll use a nice word, flexibility than he was John McCain's best bud for the longest time. John McCain dies, and now he's holding hands with Trump, maybe literally, but certainly figuratively. It's like, okay, you almost couldn't pick more diametrical ends of your party, and there you are.
Right, exactly.
Spineless. All right, I'll stop. So you also sent me an article about Mark Robinson, the lieutenant governor of North Carolina, who is running to replace the aforementioned Roy Cooper, and I have a little bit of a beef with the headline, although I don't think it's that wrong. So the headline was something like, North Carolina governor candidate says some people need killing, And I watched the actual speech, and he kind of used it in a military sense at first, and was like, you know, right. we had to fight the Nazis, we had to kill the Nazis, we had to kill the Japanese. Now, he claimed that they bombed us, and then we went and attacked their army and navy. There's a little revisionist history there, because Nagasaki and Hiroshima were not military targets.
Right.
But, so knowing history apparently is no longer a requirement in U.S. Politics. But, so... It'll get framed as he was talking about sometimes war is necessary, and that, you know, in the case of the Nazis and us getting attacked by Japan, it's an unfortunate truth. But he's also apparently in the past referred to members of the LGBTQ community as maggots. I believe he's a Holocaust denier. I mean, yep. he's a guy I have little regard for based on the admittedly little I know about him. And the fact that he's up there doing this in a church, you know, sometimes people need to be killed. Doesn't sound very Christian to me. I've been out of the church for a while, so maybe there have been some revisions, but that's not what I remember. And again, he's saying the quiet part out loud. In fact, he's screaming the quiet part, and people are eating it up.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I sent you the article. It wasn't just necessarily about what he said, but it's to get behind why he said what he said and why he makes a lot of the statements that he does. I think you'll hear in a lot of news articles, in a lot of news coverage, you'll hear a little bit of mention about this, but I've never seen anybody dig into why the nationalist, the Christian right nationalist movement, and a lot of the supporters of Trump believe what they do, and how that applies to politics and et cetera. And he is one of these that they basically, it gets down to what's called the Seven Mountain Mandate. This was a Christian idea that was brought about by Lauren Cunningham back in the 70s. Lauren Cunningham founded a group called YWAM, which is Youth with a Mission. It's a mission group. My sister participated in that for a couple of years. And I know all this because I was brought up, my dad was a pastor, Southern Baptist, charismatic. So I was brought up, raised up in the whole evangelical, charismatic, Pentecostal type, movement, very much was involved in church up until just here, the last maybe 10 years, kind of went through my own deconstruction, if you will. And real shift in my spirituality, but understanding what the Seven Mountain Mandate is and why this is important to them and why you're seeing this from guys like Charlie Kirk at the Heritage or Charlie Kirk and the guys at the Heritage Foundation and other groups. Basically, it's an idea or concept that there are seven mountains of influence over society, and that being like family, religion, politics, education, media, business, government, entertainment. And so the whole concept is, and the idea is to bring the government of heaven, if you will, the government of Christ to earth, and to influence all these areas for God. So that's their motive. That's what they're seeking to do. And it's I would almost parallel it with some of the QAnon stuff, in that there's the real Q believers, but then there's a lot of concepts and ideas from that get leached out into mainstream, and you got people who will believe some of the theories and all of that and not even realize that that's what it's tied to. And it's the same thing with the Seven Mountain Mandate idea, that there's a lot of concepts of that have gotten more mainstream within the church, and a lot of people in the church don't even realize that's what it is or that's what it's tied to, but they buy into it. And so it's all about theology. It's all about understanding their doctrine and their belief system, and that they believe they have to influence all of these areas, and it's about bringing the rule of God's kingdom to earth, which is, by all intents and purposes, a theocracy. And that's, for me, where I've come to is what scares the hell out of me about the Republican Party, about conservatives, about, you know, a right-wing government, if you will, especially the nationalist movement, because that's what we're headed to. And there's a lot about that that people take and can take extreme, just like with Islam or any other religion, and they can use violence or any other means to push that agenda or push those ideas. So you've got guys spouting language that somebody can take the wrong way, and then, you know, as you've seen in the past, bombing of abortion clinics or murdering abortion doctors, et cetera, et cetera. So it's just something that, if it's fully realized, it literally scares the hell out of me. And I think it ties in with this whole Project 2025 concept that you wanted to talk about as well, because it's really one of the leading factors behind the whole development of that as well.
That's
where these guys are coming from. And that's what people have to understand. But then too, I think you get bit players that come in and hijack it because they know the audience they're speaking to and they're trying to rally support. And so they'll talk the language, even though they may not actually fully believe it. But you've got hardcore full believers, and you've got a lot of people that when they hear that language, it's a dog whistle. They know what the person's talking about, and they're going to get all behind it and get all behind that person.
Yeah, and I mean, first of all, the idea that Trump is a good Christian leader is freaking laughable to me. I mean, like, right. How can you not look right at the guy and say, okay, let's forget the third marriage, cheating on the pregnant wife with a porn star, or recent mother with a porn star, whatever. Forgetting all of the infidelities there. The fact that he's got his name in gold on everything that he wants to, I mean, the hubris is his brand. I mean, it's right. Not even subtle. And yet, oh no, he's a good Christian. He's selling Bibles with the Constitution in it. And I bring this guy up every now and then. There's a guy who hangs out at my local pub who is just into the cult beyond belief. And you talk to the guy, and he's a nice guy. And we'll talk about hockey, and we'll talk about stuff, and then he'll immediately just, you know, turn into cult guy. And the second the other day he did the whole thing with, he comes up and asks me, do you think Big Mike is going to take over for Biden? And I'm like, okay, I don't know who Big Mike is. Oh, it's Michelle Obama. And I'm like, oh, here we go again with this nonsense. Well, yeah. I'm not saying it's true, but I heard she might be a man. I'm like, oh, fuck off. And yet, so no trouble spewing that nonsense and then say anything even slightly critical of Trump, and it's just knee-jerk reaction, shell, walk away, and it's like, wow, you are that fragile when it comes to your guy, and yet you're going to make a joke and say there could be some validity to the former first lady is actually a man, even right. though she's got two kids that were born before they were anyway.
Yeah, it would be laughable if it wasn't just the fact that so many people really are,
and normal
going down
people
that rabbit hole. And it gets to be, it's no longer laughable. It's actually kind of scary.
No, it's definitely scary. It's people in routine society just walking around. I mean, this guy sells furniture for a living. You know, right. The guy you're buying a couch from is talking about how, you know, Biden's a psyop and he's being controlled by Barack Obama, Michelle Obama's a man. I'm like, my God, man, you function as a human, and yet you believe this shit. And to a point you were making before, there are definitely people who seize the opportunity, and they know they're spewing bullshit, but they don't care because it's working for them. I would put Trump in that category. I would put Ann Coulter and Rush Limbaugh in that
right.
camp. But then there's people who genuinely believe this shit, and I don't know which one's worse. One at least is one's an opportunist, and the other is just deluded to the point of, I don't know how you manage to function in society, and yet there you are. It's
right.
absolutely amazing. So going to Project 2025, if you don't know anything about it, and frankly, I didn't know a whole lot until this week when it started trending, it is basically the Heritage Foundation's vision of what a next Trump presidency could be, or what a conservative presidency should be. And it includes things like getting rid of the National Oceanographic Institutes or whatever. It's the NOAA. I forget what the acronym stands for, because right. they're promoting dangerous climate science, whatever. And, you know, so we can't talk about the climate because it's not good for a lot of things, including the gas and oil industry. So, okay, we'll just get rid of it. Get rid of the Department of Education. The best part is one of the other things they want to do is make pornography illegal, which right. good luck selling that on college campuses right. or at my house. They're very radical, extreme right, extreme conservative Christian-based philosophies, and Trump is now coming out saying, oh, I've never heard of Project 2025, but I've learned about them, and I agree with some of the stuff, and some of the stuff I don't. And it's like, okay. First of all, if you haven't heard of it, that's almost as big an indictment of your situational awareness as if you had.
Right.
And, back to the not being held accountable. He gets to tap dance around the, there's good people on both sides, yada, yada, yada. It's worked for him before, and it's probably going to work for him again. If you want to jump in on 2025, I'm all ears, but I kind of want to revisit something else you said.
Yeah, no, I think, that's part of Trump's big tool politically is his ambiguity. And he just constantly will affirm or deny or do both, and nobody seems to really hold him very accountable for it, not within his own circles. But that's, I think, one of his political tools is, he probably fully well knows. And if he's had the involvement of the people that he's had within his circle, there's a lot of his former policymakers and advisors and all were involved in writing, helping develop Project 2025. So there's no way that he doesn't know at least a good bit about that. But I think it's the whole point of the project is basically to empower the executive branch
right.
to be able to execute with impunity what it wants and desires. It's the whole concept, really, I think. And I, from a certain aspect, I get the frustration. You elect the president. He's there for 8 years. He deals with a lot of bureaucratic institutions underneath, whether it's the FBI or the State Department or whoever. You have certain appointees that he can place that will run it, but you have the majority of those branches are, the working class, if you will, are people who are their career people. They're there for their career. Presidents come and go. They're there to keep doing their jobs. And so there's oftentimes, that's why you'll see the State Department clash with the executive branch, with the president on certain policies or certain things, because there's stuff they've had in the works for 20, 30 years, and he comes in, wants to make a change, and they don't agree with it. And so it's that level of frustration is what they're trying to address with this. And basically, let's eliminate all these people, make them all appointees to carry out the president's exact desires and wishes. And then when some of those desires and wishes in that document line up with the Seven Mountain Mandate that I just previously talked about, then, you're looking at a very empowered executive branch getting rid of a lot of the checks and balances, if you will, and carrying out, basically turning the nation into an authoritarian theocracy. And I'm talking extreme in that sense, but that's the real possibility of if this is carried out, then that's where we're headed towards. And that to me is a very scary possibility. It's the literal old adage. And, I say this, but I do mean it. It doesn't matter if it's the left boot or right boot of government, if it's on your neck. And that's what bothers me about the extremes of both sides.
No, that's valid. And to, add to your point, this isn't like this could evolve into this. This is what they're trying to do. This is their right. stated goal. Sometimes, let's go with the Clinton crime bill, which ends up pretty much being a disaster in terms of putting nonviolent criminals in prison for life because they sold weed 3 times.
Right.
In theory at the time, it was applauded by a lot of people, me among them. And then you look at the long-term ramifications and they're pretty awful. Right. In this case, they're saying, yeah, we want the awful. We want a theocracy, and this is sort of, tying it back to what we discussed earlier. There's no one who is rah-rah Biden. I mean, of the people that have been on the show recently, you, me, and Steve, I'm his biggest supporter, and I'm lukewarm at best. Now, right. I'm going to vote because I think Trump is a literal danger to our democracy and our country, and I'll vote for Biden with my nose plugged. But what concerns me the most about that debate performance and the subsequent attempt to turn things around is it triggers apathy. When you see someone up there looking that bad, then coming back going, yeah, I know I look bad, but let's all let that go and look at me now. I'm made up and on camera and, you know, sending you a tape or recorded message. It's going to turn off people who might have voted and might have voted Biden into I'm not going to bother. And the right. I'm not going to bother voter is what got us Trump in 2016.
In political and election history, it is more often that people will turn out to vote for something than voting against something. It's more of a motivating factor. One of the rare exceptions, I think, is Biden beating Trump this last time around. I think he got a lot of support for people voting against Trump. And whereas this time around, I don't know if that's going to be enough because of Biden's performance, you know, because of where he is exactly. I feel like it's going to do exactly that, create a lot of apathy at this point and probably not have as big a turnout, which is going to do more for Trump.
Right.
And that's where I think possibly I'm not a big fan of Kamala Harris at all, but I do feel like if there were at least another debate or two, she might perform admirably better and could perhaps kind of stem some of that apathy and get more people fired up to come out and vote.
Well, that's a low bar to clear because outperforming right. Biden's last debate performance would be, I'm not trying to think of what wisecrack to make about, you know, the average potato could have done better. And you know, I don't have a strong opinion on Kamala Harris. You know, the irony is she's kind of in the position she's in because she beat up on Biden in the Democratic primary debate, and they right. literally chose her as a if we can't beat her, join her or get her to join us situation. I've read articles that if the Democrats choose anyone to replace Biden other than Harris, it'll turn off black female voters, which is a demographic that Biden did very well with in 2020. Right. And that I don't necessarily know if that's true or not. I can do the math and see if I can understand why people would say that, but I don't know that there's all that much of a groundswell for Kamala Harris. But, you know, I don't have a strong opinion on her, but if she's the only choice between Biden, Trump, and her, I'm going with her. I know it's not, right. And that's not an apples thing because she would have to step in where Biden steps down. But, you know, you're definitely right about the money aspect of it, that the Democratic Party isn't going to give back $200 million because their guy decided I'm too old for this shit.
Right.
And so sticking with, you know, media articles that may have headlines or whatever that are misleading. And let me start off by saying I'm very mixed and I'm certainly not a fan of Robert Kennedy Jr. But I see a headline right. the other day. Is it true that RFK Jr. ate barbecued dog? And I'm like, okay, it's one of those, okay, I'll bite. And apparently there's right. a picture of him in Korea years ago eating an unidentified type of meat at a Korean barbecue. And first of all, I don't think I would eat dog. I'll try almost anything ethnic cuisine wise.
Right.
I don't know if I could make the jump to dog. Could you?
Probably not knowingly. I mean, I've traveled to Europe a good bit. I know throughout Europe, especially Switzerland, like horse is a delicacy there, and that's something in America that is very, very frowned upon. But there's a lot of things in a lot of places culturally that, you know, we may not accept, but it's culturally acceptable there. And I'm not going to necessarily criticize or judge
on that level.
And so it's also, I know in a lot of cultures, if you're offered something to eat and you turn it down, it's very highly offensive. So I'm not going to criticize him based on that kind of thing, but I also know how easily that gets turned in American culture and, oh my God, he ate dog. What a, you know, right. how terrible. but we don't know one way or the other. But it's just, again, it's like I think a lot of the things dealing with RFK right now, it's just he poses a threat where Biden needs every vote he can get, and I think he's probably going to pull a little bit more from Democrat voters than he is the other side. Yeah, they're going to try to bury him in every way possible. And they've even said as much. You know, they see him as a threat, and they're going after him.
This article also brought up his heroin addiction, and he apparently, as a young man, did have drug addiction issues, and he's acknowledged that. And I know plenty of people who did dumb shit as a young person or got involved in bad things as a young person to turn their life around. So I wouldn't necessarily hold that against him. There was also a remark that he'd been accused of sexual assault, and I was like, well, that's par for the course for Kennedys, but go on. And that's a pretty gross thing for me to say, but it's also can be backed up pretty well. So the sexual assault allegation came from like a former nanny or something of that nature who claims he took off his shirt and asked her to put lotion on his back and that he put his hands on her hips. And I'll grant you that's creepy. It's gross. It's inappropriate. But if that's sexual assault, I've been sexually assaulted thousands of times. I mean, I've had people come up to me and put their hands on me when I didn't want them to. I'm like, okay, what are you doing? That's not sexual assault. It can or can't, it can be creepy or inappropriate or not, depending on your relationship with the individual. But to frame that as sexual assault and count on people to not dig deeper and go, okay, this was no worse than Biden sniffing someone's hair. In fact, maybe Biden's hair sniffing antics is worse than that.
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously borders, you know, there were borderlines crossed there. If the situation is vetted out, it's true. I'm not going to deny what she felt or how she was treated in that situation. But at the same time, you also look at this and realize trying to find every possible allegation or whatever they could bring against him to bury the guy.
And it's the framing of it is what I was objecting to.
If there's something that's really there, then let the truth come out and let's deal with it. That's just how I see it. But also, you know, it's like every allegation against every other political figure, whether it be Kavanaugh or whoever, that has come out in the last 20 years, this is a normal political tactic that's used. But again, I don't want to demean or diminish in any way her allegations or her response if that's what she's coming out with.
And I'm just objecting to the use of that term for something that is, if that's the breadth of the term sexual assault, if it's everything from Bill Cosby or Harvey Weinstein to, you know, hey, put lotion on my back, that's too big of a bucket for me. If you were to put out an article saying RFK Jr. has history of inappropriate, creepy behavior with younger women, okay, it's inappropriate and creepy. I'm not going to deny that. But if you're not going to go to a judge and say, he asked me to put lotion on his back, I'm pressing charges, and have anything other than either do it or don't, but you're not putting someone in jail for that. I feel creepy defending this. And it's a shitty situation to be in, but when I was reading the article, I'm like, this is a hatchet job, and it's a hatchet job against someone that I frankly wish would go away from the political scene, because I agree, I think he takes more away from Biden than from Trump. Although I have heard, because he's so anti-vax, I have heard some people say that they would vote for him if Trump wasn't in the race. Now, Trump is in the race, so it doesn't matter.
I think some of his stances, it's interesting. That's what everybody wants to talk about with RFK, is his vax stance, basically. But if you start digging into his actual where he stands politically, he's a pretty progressive guy. And even his running mate leans very much towards that direction. So that's why it's interesting that people on the right would strongly consider him just because of that. But that's what tends to get all the airplay and attention. But he's an interesting figure. Like, I know we had texted back and forth with Steve at one point, and I kicked across the idea of like a, a combination ticket of him and Nikki Haley. Like, to me, that would be something very, very interesting. This, you know, pulling from two different sides and seeing how that would work. But I mean, because I'm not a fan of either. I'm not a fan of Biden, not a fan of Trump. There's nobody out there right now that I would love to throw my hat behind and support. But I find his candidacy interesting. I've listened to some interviews, long, in-depth interviews with RFK, and you know, he's an interesting guy. My pragmatic view nowadays is I don't care as much about what your political stance is, per se, as far as issues. It is important, but I'm looking to, are you an ethical leader? Are you going to make good decisions? Do you demonstrate that you can be wise and maybe work from the middle towards both sides? And that's the kind of person I would look for. And you know, again, I haven't seen enough from him to really make that decision on that. But I get it from a third party stance. He definitely could play a spoiler in this whole election, kind of like going back to the Bush and Clinton and what's the guy? Ross Perot. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Ross Perot literally won that election for Bill Clinton. There's the 10% he got, or I don't remember what it was, but it was in that ballpark. Right. He did way better than any third party candidate ever, and still only drew, you know, high single digits, I think. But that's enough to sway an election.
And when I look at, well, I think the last polling I saw for RFK Jr., he was in that 10% range support wise. So that, again, that's dangerous ground for either candidate when things are as close as they are. So.
And I back to your Nikki Haley RFK Jr. You know, comment. You made that comment like, wouldn't this be interesting? We both know it's never going to happen that way. Right. But honestly, I think I could vote for that ticket.
Yeah.
You know, I get accused of being you know in the bag for Biden. That's not true at all. I've said multiple times on this show and just in conversations. If the Republicans nominated a sane person who believed in government the way I think it's intended to be, which is, you know, basically supporting the safety of the nation from external forces, as well as providing an infrastructure for us to, you know, build our society. And you and I actually once had a conversation. You are a true libertarian. Like, you, a lot of people call themselves that. Bill Maher calls himself a libertarian, but come on. You actually believe in the principles of small government, and I think we end up agreeing on a lot of things. And you know, I'm not as anti large government when it comes to things like I would like to have a socialized healthcare program.
And that's what for me. It's I have those principles, small government. You know, I want to live in peace and be intruded on as little as possible. You know, treat people kindly and don't steal their stuff, kind of thing. You know, that's basic principles to live by. But at the same time, I'm a human being and I see people suffering. I want to help. And if there is a viable route for us to do that collectively through government, then you know what? I think that's something I can get behind, and let's figure out a way to make it work for everybody. You know, and that's kind of how I tend to see things. It's I despise injustice, whether it's race or any other form, and where we can work to make things better for everybody, then I'm all for it. But I think people that get ideologues that have such or so principled on a specific thing that you can't move and you can't be swayed one way or the other, and you refuse to move off of those points, you sometimes end up just doing more harm than good for everybody and for yourself. It's kind of back during COVID, one of the big things I kind of laughed at with conservatives was, here you're supporting, or you know this move of when it was first hitting and Trump was making the moves to start shutting everything down, we're shutting businesses down, we're doing this, that, and the other, and then government is forcing this to happen. But then you're turning around saying, well, we don't want government to help these businesses out. We don't want to, you know, provide any kind of support or whatever. It's just like, so how do you expect this to work out? You're just going to let all these businesses close and shut down? And then when we reopen, what then? Everybody's out of work. all these businesses are gone. What are we going to do? Like, I get your principle of, you know, we don't support welfare and taxpayer government, supporting giving money away to businesses and whatever, but you're also the ones that are forcing everybody to shut down. You need to provide a solution.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, the Biden's getting or takes a lot of credit for the number of jobs he's created, and mathematically he's telling the truth, but it's fair to point out that a lot of those jobs were lost during COVID and came back and really don't have anything to do with Biden's policies.
Let's be real, from talking that note, just going forward to the debates and everything else, a lot of things presidents do are economically don't typically impact until after they're out of the presidency anyway. And this whole talk about like the inflation rate and what we're going through inflation and Trump's blaming Biden for it, et cetera. I'm sorry, this ball got rolling back under George W. Bush at the end of his last term. And every president since then has enacted policies that have contributed to that fact.
Yeah, you know,
Bush, Obama, Trump, every one of them are all responsible for it. So it's not one president's responsibility. And just because we saw it finally start to kick off under Biden, this was stuff set into motion decades ago. So
yeah, and you know, I've got a good friend in the mortgage business, and that's a tough business to be in right now because interest rates have gone up dramatically in the past couple of years, and that's happened in large part because of what you're describing, kind of the chickens coming home to roost, starting with George W. Bush. Interest rates, you know, the government was basically lending money at zero interest, and we all got used to that, and it's awesome when it's going on, but it's also not economically viable. And no president wanted to be the one holding the ball when that started to come, started to play out. And now it's landing in Biden's lap. And it's a weird world to me because interest rates fell to, like I said, essentially 0%. But credit card rate interest rates didn't drop. When I was a kid, and I'm a bit older than you and Steve, you'd be encouraged to have a checking account and a savings account because the savings account was going to earn you 4 or 5% interest. And that's because interest rates for everything else were higher and the banks could pay you, give you money for holding money in their institution. And I don't know what percent. I have like $300 in a savings account because having two accounts got me free checking or whatever the reason I did it was. And I think I was making like 0.5% interest. 1/10 of what it was when I was a kid. And that's just not sustainable. It's just, there's no point in having a savings account.
Right. Well, and now even with interest rates having gone up, the banks haven't moved on most of those savings accounts. They've still have remained practically zero. That's why I went shopping around for accounts here about a year ago. Just trying to find something with better interest rates, et cetera. And, right now, I think mine, the one I'm at with the basic checking is like 2.9 or something like
that.
Wow,
that's actually...
which is a little better than average. But, and then they have a money market option, which gets a little bit better than that. So, that's just playing that shell game of keeping some of it there and then moving it over when I need it. But just trying to gain as much interest as possible. But it's been hard. It does not encourage saving or investing, which is exactly what we're seeing.
Yeah. And
in the market.
And what almost never gets talked about, it never gets talked about when there's a Republican president. It only gets talked about sparingly when you're trying to trash a Democratic president is our national debt is insane. And sooner or later, I'm not an economist, and I've heard people say that the number is really not as bad as it sounds because a lot of that debt is being paid in, U.S. bonds internally. And, I don't claim to know the ins and outs of it. I do remember as a kid when, we used to have a balanced budget, at least attempt, and then Reagan was the first one in my lifetime to just blow the budget out of the water and say, hey, spend. Deficits don't matter. And... I use the expression, it's like living on a credit card. It's a lot of fun to do until you got to pay the bills. and no president from Reagan through, Biden, with oddly the possible exception of Clinton fighting with a Republican Congress. You know, the Clinton administration actually was pretty close to having a balanced budget. And then
I was going to say, wasn't it Clinton and I think Gingrich is the last time we had any kind of balanced budget?
Yeah. And basically they traded off. Clinton was willing to cut some social programs in exchange for tax increases, and the tax increases were largely considered what they call a luxury tax. I remember a right-wing friend of mine bemoaning the hardship on yacht builders, and I'm like, are you fucking kidding me? We got to worry about the yacht builders. You know what? If you're buying a yacht and you have to downsize from a 70-footer to a 65-footer because the costs have gone up because of the luxury tax, you're going to need to give me a box of tissues because I'm tearing up hard.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm just curious. What percentage of that goes to the economy?
Right. Steve and I have joked about
things here.
Yeah, Steve and I have joked about Jerry Jones's yacht, which you've never seen it. Dallas Cowboys owner Jerry Jones has like a $500 million yacht that has like two helipads, a movie theater in it. Like, why do you own a house if you own that yacht? If Jerry Jones had to shell out $550 million because of the oppressive yacht tax, again, cry me a river.
Yeah. Well, I mean, when you got that kind of fuck you money, what does it matter?
Exactly. Exactly. All right, man, I have to bring this up every year. It fell at the beginning of the week, but July 1st marks one of my favorite days of the year. It's Bobby Bonilla Day. Are you familiar with Bobby Bonilla Day?
I am not. I'm familiar with Bobby Bonilla, but not Bobby Bonilla Day.
He gets paid like $1.7 million a year on July 1st every year until like 2030 something because of the ridiculous contract the Mets signed him to. So despite him being out of baseball for two decades, he is still getting paid $1.7 million every July 1st. And what do they say? That's good work if you can get it.
No kidding. Good job, Bobby Bo, for signing that.
Exactly. So we bring that up every year. Steve obviously isn't.
I might just have to light up a cigar today just in honor of that.
Yeah, do that. Text Steve and say I'm having a cigar for Bobby Bonilla Day, and he will know exactly what you're talking about. Anyway, thanks again, man, for coming on.
Sure.
I appreciate having you and need to have you on more. All is well down in Kentucky. What's that?
I was going to say, I absolutely appreciate you guys having me on and enjoy the conversations with you guys always.
And I want to promote. So Ben also does a YouTube podcast called My Whiskey Den. Typically broadcasts on Monday night. Is it 9 o'clock Eastern? 8 o'clock?
I believe that. I'm no longer a part of that.
Oh, geez. I look stupid.
I appreciate any support for the guys, for Patrick and Mike, that continue to carry that torch. But yeah, I believe it's still Mondays at 9 o'clock. They do a live, and they'll record different reviews. My schedule with distilling here just no longer allowed me to be able to do that as much, so I had to step down a while back. But
I'm sorry. I'm not sorry for promoting those guys, but I'm sorry for not knowing that.
Right. But no.
So
all good.
If I considered myself a journalist, this would be a real flub on my part, but I don't. I'm just a dude who talks on a podcast. All right, man. Thanks again. We are at Whiskey Congress on Instagram and Twitter, and we're done.